It's a pleasure to have you, Guillaume, talking today at the Cafe Club, virtual Cafe Club at LAM. Eventually, at some point, you will make it to Marseille in person, but we will see. We met when you were a PhD in Lyon with Johan Richard. And you got your PhD in what year?
17.
17? Yeah, the same as the two Anna's. And then you went to a postdoc in Michigan University in the US with Karen Sharon for two,
3 years.
3 years, yes. Until 2020, and you moved back. And you moved back to Europe just during COVID started.
That's great. Yeah.
It was great adventure. And you because you got another postdoc with Mathilde Jozak in Durham University in the UK. And since then you are there working and you have a big group of strong lensing there, so it's
Yeah.
must be very nice.
It's a nice conversation, nice emulsion.
Yeah, I imagine. Okay, so I think you can start.
All right. Thank you, Eric, for the presentation. Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to talk to you. So I'm gonna talk. I put scaling relation, but I think I'm gonna. I wanted more to have like a splash of like what's strong lensing, what people have done, and we can more like a discussion style presentation. And instead of starting with the usual frontier fields, I thought I put another cluster once just because it's pretty. It's not frontier field, but I'm gonna talk about different clusters on the way. So maybe a crash course quickly on what is lensing, what is and strong lensing and lensing. So you have a source, and this source is going to have like three main transformation. So it's a displacement, it's going to be like located elsewhere, an amplification and a shear, and all of this happen at the same time to distort the image. And so here, if you put a galaxy, I'm going to have a show you a little animation. So you have a source, and I'm gonna increase the mass of the lens plane, if you put, and that's gonna distort the image, and you could see the effect of lensing, and that's the main source. And at some point, the mass is strong enough that you actually have multiple images that's coming, and instead of having only one image of the source, you have two another that's appearing here. Usually, to be able to constrain this mass, it's nice to have several sight lines. So you would want another galaxy here, symbolized as the blue galaxy. I'm gonna hide you. Well, only keep one of you. Symbolized as the second galaxy here in blue. And if I were to change the location of the blue and fix the location of the red, you can see that the shape of the profile on the inside is gonna influence the position of the image. So ideally, you would want different sight lines to be able to constrain the profile of the lens plane. And there is many things that can happen for this profile. And here I wanted to show you a bit of how you could change this. What's the shape of the galaxy lens going to change with when you change if you have a core profile or more like a cusp profile? So, sorry. Well, it starts on the right. So, this animation on the right is changing the ellipticity of the profile, and you could see like how it's like moving slightly the image on that side, and here you. It's a change of the core. So you could see that different change. So the ellipticity, you see that has some rotation, and the core is gonna like move the image toward the center or away from the center. And this is all this combination of effect that we're trying to harness, and like with the geometrical fit that we're gonna do with lensing, trying to constrain the profile, the mass distribution, because that's what we are looking for. Another thing that people have looked at and talked a lot is the mass redshift degeneracy, which I think for me, it's a bit, overrated. You're gonna see on the animation. So if I change the redshift from 2 to 7, that's how little it's gonna move. And if I change the mass from, like, let's say a big galaxy to a small cluster, like the change is much, much, much stronger. So actually the redshift is a parameter, can affect, but it's not really the main driver of your uncertainties that would go into your mass distribution. Actually placing the source at redshift, I don't know, between 2 and 7 won't change a lot for one source. So feel free to interrupt me, and then I'm gonna slightly move on to more consideration on the Sprung-Lens model that we have. And this one is the number of constraints. So this is a plot that's showing you the relative error on the mass according to the number of multiple images that you have. And here are the 6 frontier field cluster, and people have talked a lot about that. There are like, so to be like some of achievements of that, but that's only 6 cluster. Actually, most of the cluster live there and even more there. So some of the samples that are out there that people have gathered, like it's tens of multiple images. So, and some of cluster have even less. So we need really to understand what is going on when we model a cluster and the uncertainties and harness, like how it goes, because otherwise we won't be able to say something. We need to understand where the error goes. So this Johnson and Chowan did an attempt at that. And when you look at this plot, this is you could see as the uncertainties on the magnification compared to a fiducial model, according to the number of constraints you have. And the symbols are the number, no, yeah, the symbols give you the number of non-spectroscopic constraints, and the color give you the number of spectroscopic constraints, so with redshift. And you can see that there is some sort of a sweet spot around 2025 where it's consistent, and then suddenly it's consistent. So you can focus maybe on the lower triangle red at the middle here. That's, so the lower triangle red means that you have a lot of constraint even with no spectroscopic redshift to have them. So the number of constraints win in that case. And if you have a lot of spectroscopic constraint, of course you are there, and you could see that the red is going from there to there, and then you have like this natural shift, but the sweet spot you already is around 2025, according to that plot, to find the nice magnification. Okay, telling you a little bit of some of what I did. So this is Hubble 2744, it has been observed by Muse. And before Muse, there was 5 images with SPECZ, and then there was 89 images with SPECZ. So it's a huge jump, even if the depth of the frontier field was already giving us so many constraints. So another challenge that rose is, what do we gain really in having so many more redshifts? Because I told you that there is this sweet spot that you're already constrained. So you somehow gain a better handle on the mass transfer. The total mass, the total magnification is going to be similar, but you have like these differences in where the mass is located. So here you see on a color map with the the same model without this much spectroscopic constraint and the one with the spectroscopic constraint. And what's interesting here is to compare the blue, the dark blue, and the red here. That gives you the idea that there is a mass transfer between one part of the cluster to the other part of the cluster. And that it has been able to be brought by this huge amount of spectroscopic constraint. And so in this, we have so many constraints on the on this that we were even sensitive to the outskirts of the cluster. So the mass, that's where the strong lensing part is, where the Muse field of view of the observation is. It's a 2x2 arc minute. And the mass here were sensed into the position of the multiple images. And mainly was done sensed through the shear. That's the shear effect of this outskirts mass. And to give you a sense of what does the shear do, I have this little animation where you have like some sort of a mock cluster that resembles the previous one. And in magenta, you have the position of the multiple images. And I'm going to increase the shear onto like that direction. And it's going to appear in cyan. And you can see that you have this effect, this eyeball effect of that's appearing because of the shear. Okay, so people, I mean, some of you may know this quite well. You can use also strong lensing to have constraint on cosmology. And here there have been a model of the frontier field cluster, and they try to change the cosmology and see their influence on various properties. So on the left here, you could see like the mass, the difference in mass according to different cosmology for different cluster. But I think this is like marginal in mass, but what I found quite interesting in that paper is this plot, it's the uncertainty on the magnification of the model and compared to the fiducial, and you could see that some cluster, they are like around one, which is like nothing change on the uncertainty of the magnification according to your cosmology. But some cluster were much more sensitive to the cosmology. And I found this idea quite interesting that not all the clusters are the same to probe cosmology. And somehow I wanted to relate that to what Anna Acebon, that you might know very well, has done regarding the cosmology and also its relation to the profile that you use. There are some profile that's going to give you like a close, you're going to be closer to the defined cosmology. This is done with simulation. So like actually the profile and the shape really matter, and you need to be to do a tedious job at trying to have the best profile. And there is work that needs to be done to understand why some profiles just won't give you the right results. Okay, so I'm just gonna jump to another consideration that I need some background to give you to able to like have a grasp at what it's gonna be. So I just wanted to pause for a second if anyone has a question on what has been done. And I'm told that I just need to wait long enough that it's awkward, and it means that there is no question. Okay, it's awkward. I'm moving on. So when we model for parametric model, usually we have like this simplistic idea that there is like a big dark matter cluster clump. We're trying to have this modeled separately. We have the lensing constraints in green, and then we have the cluster member, and they are all modeled as one galaxy, and we rescale this galaxy according to the luminosity. So we have like this scaling relation, like fits one parameters of the L star galaxy, and then we rescale it. But this can give you like this rescale, and how we rescale can give you a different sub-Elo mass fraction. So if you want to study what's the how cluster evolve in a cluster and what it's going to happen to them, it can matter to have like the proper scaling relation to do that, because as the schematic show, they have the same mass. But where is the mass? Is it in the cluster members or is it at the cluster scale level? So that's why it's really important to have that. And that's one illustration with a real cluster and the mass contours. And you see that this little round thing, that's are the cluster member galaxy, and the big thing represents more like the dark matter. And how do you like scale that one with the other? So we did that. We looked at the David Lagatuta pilot program that calls the Buffalo Wings, and has huge Muse footprints on ABLS370. And we extract the spectra of the galaxy and try to see if we can tell something about this scaling relation. So that's what you have here. That's this plot. So we took all the cluster member galaxy, ranked them in magnitude, and here we measure their velocity dispersion thanks to the Mu spectra. And then we fit the mass luminosity relation, because that's what it is. It's like this, the velocity dispersion is the direct proxy for mass in our modeling of cluster. And what we use usually as the rule is a constant mass luminosity relation. That's what we have in the model that we do, and that's the red one. But when I fit with all the data, I get the green one. So it's a tiny bit, give more mass to the brightest galaxy. If I only use the bright galaxy, like above L star, magnitude 20, which is about L star, I've got something very, very steep. And if I use only the faint galaxy, it's the black line, I have something that is much more shallow and actually closer to what we have originally. And from that, that's what would give you the difference between the cluster members. So you see on the left, that's the original one. In the middle, it's the one with the full fit. And when you look at with your eye, you don't see any difference. But when you do the subtraction of the two, you get these maps of the cluster member mass. And you could see that the brightest galaxy there, they are much more massive in that subtraction than the faint one. And that's why they appear in black here. So there is really like, it's very important to like have a grasp and understanding on how much galaxy you have, like what do you fit? And maybe we need to improve in the future on our scaling relation. So some people have done that a bit. There is Bergamini et al. Paper that, how am I doing with time? Oh, speed up a little bit. There is the Bergamini paper that show different scaling relation for three different clusters. But actually, they don't go very deep. And I was wondering like how much like this affects and their results. But overall, when you compare the three clusters, the slope alpha is always about the same. So maybe there is some constant there that one can look at. So, well, I think I leave you with my conclusion here. So there is like many systematics that we need to understand to be able to model the cluster properly. And that's very important for like the profile of the mass distribution. What can we do? And searching for good lengths. I could also, I have a plot maybe if we have time later to show you. That's quite interesting regarding the profile. So there is also the cosmology that matter with mass, the redshift, And the outskirts, it's quite important. So we need to take that into account. It's been used with the shear, external shear, added to the model sometimes. And there is this idea of mass transfer between sub-halo and cluster halo. And thank you for your attention.
Yes, thank you very much. So I don't know if someone has a question.
It seems that you have other slides hidden.
Yeah, I have. I have other slides. That's one of my favorites. So if there is no immediate question, I'll show you that after. I think there is a question.
Is there a question?
Yeah, Roger has a question.
Thank you, Guillaume, for the presentation. I have a question. I don't know if I understood everything correctly or not, but I am curious to know if you have compared at some point the velocity dispersion that you obtain from the modeling for these galaxies with the velocity dispersion that could be measured from the MUSE data, for instance. I don't know if it's possible, but is it at the limits? But do you think that such a comparison will help understanding what is going on here in this, let's say, distribution between the sub-halos and the larger halos of the dark matter?
Yes, I think that it would help, and something that I haven't really seen. So in Bergamini, I can like increase a bit. In the Bergamini's paper, they use the fixed aperture, and I think that somehow with MUSE and the IFU, we can like go beyond that and have like a more holistic approach where we take the natural shape of the cluster member. And I was wondering if it would make sense even to have like two scaling relation, like one for the very bright galaxies that have their own history, and to be able to build such mass, they have to have come a certain path in their life. And maybe that life is different from the life of the small cluster member galaxy. So having two scaling relation maybe makes sense. And if I squeeze my eyes enough, I even want to fit like a relation here and a relation there that are not the same. Like maybe having and the yellow for the bright and the black or the red for the faint one. I don't know. And I think it deserves some help and some better some improvements. And we need to go deep for that. So deep MUSE data.
So these are data, right? So these are measurements.
Yes, that's data.
Down to magnitude 24?
Yeah.
Well, it's quite noisy, no?
It is, but there are still like confidence 3 spectra in our ranking. So there, we are sure that it's there. I mean,
how can you get a velocity dispersion of 1,000?
Well, I fit with sigma clipping, so this is not included in the fit. But these are mistakes that like the. Because those are too noisy, indeed, like it's hard to like get something proper. But I didn't want to hide the one that failed, so it's right there. But yeah, no, that's 1,000. I don't believe that, even if it's
telling. Okay. You fit with a sigma clip. I see.
Yeah. So.
And you include the error bars also in the fit, probably.
But the error bars on the sigmas are quite small. I don't like. I need to rerun PPXF a couple of times to be sure that I'm getting that right. But yeah, it's a bit of a black box PPXF. I don't know if some people have made a lot of experience in that.
I see. Complete measurements. So yeah, maybe you want to discuss this.
There was the last one. So I was doing some project with students at Michigan, and we were trying to see if we can try to find what's a good lens, what makes a cluster a good lens. And we came up with this idea that the slope is actually a good indicator, and that's the plot there. So the A is the magnification area. So that's the lensing strength. How much of the surface that you can see is lensed, is magnified above 3. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And S50 to 200, that's the slope of the density profile. So the flatter you are, the more of a good lens you can be. And peaky cluster cannot be good lens, because this area is empty. You cannot have a peaky profile and have a large lensing strength. You cannot be a peaky profile and have a lot of magnification area.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that quite interesting. I wonder if there is some cosmological limits that we could draw from that.
So it's kind of a selection effect as well. If you reverse the relation, imagine you take a given set of clusters, you have no idea about their profile, but you take them because you observe some strong lensing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do the modeling, you find them to be quiet quad profile.
Yeah.
It might be a false representation of reality, because in fact, when you did the selection, you selected only the ones with the core profiling.
Because that's the only one that shows strong lensing.
Exactly.
Mm. Yeah, it might very well be.
Wow.
I still have a hard time to see how could you have such a, well, how would you approach to get like the density profile of those, like putting some x-ray? I mean, it's, for me, it's already like the strong lensing one are almost about the most massive cluster ever. So just, I wonder how you could build enough mass to have a peaky profile and large magnification. See what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you mean, but there is a factor of 10 almost between in area. So it's not a small bias. So. You see, you go up to 10.
Sorry, I don't understand what you're.
Yeah, on the
y-axis,
mm-hmm. It goes from 0 to 12.
Mm-hmm. So the area can be quite
big. So the area can be quite different, depending
on... you can only achieve such area if your slope is...
quite flat.
Quite flat, sorry.
Oh, yeah, I know, but you see, I mean, it's a strong effect. If you select clusters which have a quite large area,
mm-hmm.
you are pretty sure to have a quite flat profile.
Yes. That's what we were looking. So ideally, down the line, to select the best lens.
And there is no such, and it doesn't seem to be also a big connection with the mass.
There is none. Yeah, there is. I mean, the mass is bad proxy. I have that plot somewhere. Yes, I have cluster redshift and mass, and actually, you can see that it's quite spread. Doesn't give you any indication. Mass is not a good proxy to find good lens. So that's why we are looking at something else. And I'd like to see a visual proxy for the slope of the density profile, but I didn't find it. Because down the line, I had in mind that well, Euclid is going to have so many clusters. How do you select the good one? Because maybe you just don't see the lensing yet and you need deeper data. So like I'd find something that gives me this.
Well, I don't know if you have to select the good or the bad ones, but even if you do an analysis with all of them, before you can draw any conclusion about the slope of the clusters, you need to take this selection function into account. You need to correct your findings about the slope of the clusters by this possible bias in the selection function.
You mean like?
You see, if you take 100 clusters,
yeah,
which have a strong lensing, according to your figure, it says that you have a good chance that among the hundreds you took, many of them have are quite flat.
Flats, yeah.
And this means that you could have also other clusters with steeper curves, but they do not have a strong lensing in them.
Yes, I agree. But that, so if I want to say something about clusters, that's something that I need to take into account. If I care about the lensed universe, is behind the cluster, that's less.
Oh, no, yeah, this is another story here.
Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Well,
yeah, with that project, I had more in mind the universe behind it. But yeah, I agree. That doesn't tell you something general about cluster.
I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are questions, maybe, Laurence?
Yes. Hello, Guillaume. About this slide, could you explain to us why, I guess there are different tools, Lens tool, LTM, GravLens, Grail, why they are giving so different results? Yes, I mean, is it, are they run on the exactly the same data set first? And what are their main differences?
So they are not all exactly the same data sets, but it's the difference is small enough that it's not really the constraint that's bringing the uncertainty. So some of the models, we took them as of courtesy because they are public and it's nice to show them. I don't believe in all of them, but I think what would be the main difference, it would be, it's not that easy to be able to compare them. But
why do you say that you don't believe in all of them? What are their drawbacks?
Some of them do not use so one of them, for instance, they have like their galaxies, their cluster member, they are like round instead of elliptical, and I think that's can change on the configuration of some of the multiple images location. And down the line, that's also affects the mass transfer between the, it's all very interconnected. But for me, one of the main effects is the sub-Elo mass fraction. So if you have like a big mass that is at the cluster scale and that dominates the signal, the slope is very different than if you have like more mass in the cluster member galaxy. So it's really like intricate mass distribution that reconstruct the profile that's gonna end up here. And if the cluster is more round or more elliptical, this would be affects that too. But it's quite hard to like pinpoint one thing that makes them different. They all have little differences. But yeah. Like, so, for instance,
yeah. So as you said that, you know, some clusters are better than others,
mm-hmm.
as a cosmological probe,
mm-hmm.
that it would mean that to make the selection of the better one would depend on the tool that you are using. And I would guess that you prefer Lens tool than the other. So, I mean, how are you are deciding, you know?
So that's really hard. And I think that's why it's still important to have like different teams that compare different software. But learning all the software, it's kind of a big game. But there is this hope that if you have enough constraint, you're going to be closer to the truth. So it's just like we really need to add a lot of constraint for that, and especially for the cosmology. But it depends the question you ask, because if you only want the mass within, let's say, 300 kiloparsecs, that every model can give you that. And it's quite robust, the mass enclosed. It's when you try to get some other things that it can get tricky. And I don't think there is a good answer to that. Maybe Eric or Marceau have like a better idea, but I think it's just like this hope that the more constraint you have, the more you are closer to the truth. Just need a ton of constraint.
Okay, thank you.
I think at some point I've seen another question.
I had a question, I was wondering whether it's still worth me asking. But yes, so I was a bit surprised by the fact that you don't see so much correlation between the area and the mass. At least you claim that there is not such a strong correlation.
Yeah.
So most often, when you use the lensing cross section, so in the source plane, the cross section in the source plane for multiple imaging or for the criterion can be this thing, all the source plane area that ensures that you will have a total magnification greater than something. So this correlates very well with the mass, the total mass, because to the first order, it's the enclosed mass that drives the Einstein radius, the size of the Einstein radius.
But you think about that, maybe I'm taking too much of imagining to extrapolate too much of what you're saying. That's you thinking about galaxy lensing, and that's, I think it's true for galaxy lensing. I mean, it makes sense to me. I didn't check, but for clusters, there is some. I think it's the combined effect. Where did I put that?
No, I agree that at constant mass, if you spread it more, it's the other way around. At constant mass, a compact galaxy, a point mass, will be more efficient a lens than the
yes, but I think for clusters, they are at this point where it's the extended mass that reach the point. And here you have like these 3D clusters, and the kappa, so kappa equal one is like, let's say, like when you're gonna start doing the lensing. And I think they are like flat and reach this amount of mass that everything starts to be a lens to enter the magnification quite quickly.
And I think you this is just a matter of selecting the sample. This is exactly what you say, Rafael. Here, Guillaume is focusing on clusters. So already this is a narrow range of mass, in fact. So you are not sensitive anymore to the actual mass because they are quite all massive.
Yeah.
But you are sensitive to other effects like
Substructure.
Yeah, substructure, slope. But on a global picture, of course, if you compare a galaxy and a cluster will produce more arcs and will be more efficient as a lens telescope than a galaxy.
Yeah, okay. And the scaling, I'm not sure I understood the finding in terms of scaling relations. So you don't fit for the, do you fit for each individual cluster the intercept and the slope of the scaling relation between mass and velocity dispersion? And you wonder why it's different from one cluster to the next, or?
No, I wonder. So this is only one cluster. I wonder why it's so different if I only fit the bright galaxy and the faint galaxy. And I think it's, I'm worried.
Okay.
And when
you do the fit, do you have to allow some galaxies to depart from the deterministic scaling relation, or can you afford to do that? So because this is a problem that when you place all the galaxies along the strict list along the scaling relation, of course you cannot afford to open up too many degrees of freedom, but in a Bayesian way, with some sort of hierarchical Bayesian manner, could you release allow galaxies to depart from the deterministic scaling relation?
So for clusters, I think we need
cluster members.
But when we see, when we model clusters, I think there is no constraint near the cluster member, like strong lensing constraint or any kind of lensing constraint. There is not enough constraining power to have a handle on the individual. But if like there is galaxy-galaxy lensing within that galaxy in the cluster, usually we model them separately, completely. They do not relate to the relation at all.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think, even in the Bayesian way, I don't see that there would be constraint to have just, let's say, like some galaxy that vary along this line. Oh, maybe that's an interesting idea. Maybe there is something like, and the scatter would make us learn on how like we relate to.
Well, first of all, you could absorb some of the scatter in your general inability to reach a perfect fit to the multiple images. So some of the source of scatter could be absorbed by this the noise you like in the model,
yeah,
the scaling relation, but also the zero point, the intercept would be better. I don't know the second point. I'm not sure it would be useful to. It would help you control some systematic, for instance, if your sample of cluster members is incomplete, if galaxies along the line of sight would matter or not in the modeling. But this is just a random thought.
No, you're right. Well, galaxies along the line of sight, from the things that I've read, like Suyu, it doesn't matter so much, or the effect is only very local. But yeah, I think it's worth trying. I try to think about like how to approach the scatter in the relation. Thanks. It's a good point.
There is an option in Lens Tool to include the scatter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well,
we'll have a look.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe I email you separately.
Yeah.
I can look at the Lens Tool documentation.
Yeah. Look at the code better.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Thanks, Guillaume.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Guillaume.
I don't see any other question, so maybe we can stop here. Thank you. Thank you very much, Guillaume.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for staying longer.
Always nice.
I don't know if you want to discuss together, maybe we can do more. I can let the Zoom open.
I think that's okay. I look at the code. I email you if it's something more.
Okay. I will look. Let me know.